On this last section of the tapes, I'd like to talk about happiness. After all, isn't this the end or purpose of all that we've been discussing so far? Isn't it what we're all seeking individually and collectively? The question is, what is the source of happiness and satisfaction in life? What are the common beliefs in our culture and society about where happiness comes from? We're taught that happiness is a function of the following. It has to do with money. People who have more money are able to buy things that make them happy. It has to do with accomplishments and achievements. We're taught that it has to do with fame, status, and power. Or it has to do with beauty and talent. Or we believe that it has to do with pleasure and recreation. Or relationships and being in the right relationship is the source of our happiness. According to Gary Durst, the belief that we have grown up with underlying all of these qualities is that more is better. The more I have of any of these qualities, the happier I'll be. And those who are above me are lucky or more fortunate than I am. They've figured out life. They're doing it right. The problem with the more is better philosophy is that it puts me on a treadmill which paradoxically results in greater dissatisfaction. Let's stop, for example, and think for a moment about money and what money can buy. Money can buy housing, clothing, luxuries, recreation, entertainment, education. Think for a minute, how much salary does it take to be happy? I remember back in graduate school, I earned about $500 a month and couldn't wait until I graduated and could be earning $12,000 a year. Once I was earning $12,000 a year, I believed that I would be happy if I could just be earning $24,000 a year. And then it was $50,000 a year. And you see, once at $50,000 a year, I'm not satisfied until at 75 or 100 or 125. Are people who make more money happier than those who make less? My friend Steve that I talked about in the introduction doesn't think so. Or think about the car that you drive. I remember back in high school, I was so excited and thought that once I had a car, then I would have made it. Then I would really be happy. If you drive a Volkswagen, you probably think that you'll be happy when you can afford a Toyota. And once you afford a Toyota, you think you might be happy once you can buy a Cadillac and then a Mercedes. Are people who drive Mercedes happier than those who drive Fords? Think about how fun it is driving that car home from the showroom floor that first day. Drive home feeling powerful and confident and happy and excited. Pull in the garage that evening, walk into the house, and the same set of problems confront you once you get home that confronted you when you left in the morning. As you begin thinking about those problems, though, all you need to do is run out to the garage, open the door, look at that car, and you'll feel better for a few minutes. You can't wait the following day. You're excited to go to work. You rush out to the car, get in it, drive it away to work again, feeling all excited. And that lasts for a few days or even a few weeks. But gradually, the excitement begins to wear off and the fun and the feelings of confidence begin to wear off. And a Mercedes no longer is the source of that happiness and satisfaction. As a matter of fact, it becomes a pain. It becomes a problem. It's expensive to repair. Every little ding makes you feel all the more unhappy. Soon you're back in the trap of believing that more is better, wanting a bigger car or a couple of Mercedes, believing that once you have a fleet of Mercedes in your driveway, then you'll really be happy. So how much wealth does it take to really be happy? I know people who are very wealthy and happy. For many of you, that's probably the bad news. The good news is, I also know people who are very wealthy and unhappy. I also know people who have very little wealth and yet are very happy. I know people who have very little wealth and are also unhappy. Perhaps it's true that happiness really is not a function of money and a function of wealth. What about fame and accomplishments and power? Are people who have more fame or more power or more status in this society happier than those who are less well-known or have less power? Just how well-renowned does a person need to be in order to be happy? Consider Howard Hughes. Howard Hughes had everything, from money and wealth to power and status and accomplishments, and yet he died very miserable and very lonely. Or consider Richard Nixon. Oftentimes we believe that beauty is associated with happiness. Our society very much values beauty. Is a 10 naturally happier than a 5? Is Vanessa White the paragon of happiness in our society today? Ask Marilyn Monroe how much beauty is required to really be happy. I know people who are very beautiful and happy. I also know people who are very beautiful and yet hate themselves. I know people that are quite homely and have found a great deal of happiness. I know people that are quite homely and yet are also very unhappy. How much talent does it take to be happy? Think about John Belushi, somebody who had everything going for him in the early and mid-70s, who died of an overdose of heroin and cocaine. Or think about Elvis Presley. How much talent and wealth and power and fame do you think it would have taken for Elvis Presley to be happy? Or consider pleasure. Just how much recreation does it take for us to be happy? How many vacations do you have to go on before you'll really be happy? Or are people who vacation in the Bahamas somehow happier than those who go camping in the mountains nearby? Or how many trips to the movies does it take to really be happy? Or how many trips to dinner? How many games of football or basketball or tennis does a person need to play or watch in order to be happy? Or oftentimes people think that having the right relationship is what will bring them happiness. How often have you thought if you only had the right person in your life, then you would be happy, and believe that the reason you weren't happy is because of the conditions that were around you? So you've lived your life wishing and searching, but always in dissatisfaction about the way things are. Maybe more really is not better. Maybe more is just more, and happiness is not a function of more. Maybe the idea that we've been living from, that more is better, really isn't true. Maybe it's true that more is simply more. It's not good, it's not bad, it's not better, it's not worse. It's just more, and that it really is not the source of happiness in our lives. I believe that happiness is not a function of having more. As a matter of fact, whenever I give up responsibility for my happiness to all of these factors that I have been talking about that are external to me, I'm going to experience my life paradoxically from dissatisfaction, not from satisfaction. I certainly don't mean by this discussion to imply that there's anything wrong with wealth, or with beauty, or with talent, or with pleasure, or with fame and power. There isn't. What I do want to suggest is those qualities are not the source of happiness in life. It's not until I'm willing to take responsibility internally and know that happiness comes from inside, not outside, that I'm really going to experience happiness and joy and satisfaction in life. And the more I believe that happiness has to do with those externals, the more unhappy I'm likely to be. I'd like to share with you that there are two contexts or two ways that each of us can live our lives. One I'm going to call the context of scarcity. The other I'll call the context of abundance. I want to suggest that happiness has to do with which context I live my life from, and not the amount of money that I have, or the house that I live in, the car that I drive, the salary that I make, or the fame, the accomplishments, or even the talents that I possess. I recently read a book entitled The City of Joy by Dominique Lapierre. Lapierre is a French author who spent a number of years in the city of Calcutta. The story that he tells is a true story about the inhabitants of the City of Joy, which is a slum in the city of Calcutta. It's considered one of the worst slums not only in Calcutta, but in the entire world. Let me share some of the conditions that these people live in. The population density inside the city is about 200,000 people per square mile. There are 70,000 people that live within a geography three times the size of a football field. I don't mean a football stadium, just a football field. There is one tree for every 3,000 inhabitants, approximately. Most children are lucky to have ever seen a tree or a flower. Many of the inhabitants don't have a house to live in. They live on the sidewalks or cement or mud. Those who are fortunate have a piece of plastic that they can put over their heads at night or when it rains. Those who are more lucky do have a one-room or maybe a small two-room house that they live in. But several people, an extended family, will live together. 12 or 14 people will live and share one room. They don't have running water or electricity. The people in the city are lucky to have one good meal a day, and that meal will consist of a spoonful of rice, a banana, and a piece of cake or bread. That's the average diet of a person growing up in the City of Joy. The Indian people are very clean, and they'll stand for a couple of hours in the morning waiting to use the public latrines to wash themselves and go to the bathroom. The temperature in Calcutta is very, very hot and also humid. The temperature during the summer gets up to 120 degrees and will continue, sometimes unabated, for weeks on end. In the winter, the monsoons will come and the rains will begin to pour, sometimes hour after hour, even day after day. The latrines will begin to back up and the streets will be flowing with water waist deep or sometimes shoulder deep. These are the kinds of conditions that these people live in, conditions that we've never known. And yet the point of the book is that the people are able to find kindness and friendship and love and joy despite the horrible living conditions. I'd like to read just a section taken from the book that describes what I'm talking about. I'm quoting from the author. "Yet the miracle of these concentration camps was that the accumulation of disastrous elements was counterbalanced by other factors that allowed their inhabitants not merely to remain fully human, but even to transcend their condition and become models of humanity. In these slums, people actually put love and mutual support into practice. They knew how to be tolerant of all creeds and castes, how to give respect to a stranger, how to show charity toward beggars, cripples, and lepers, and even the insane. Here the weak were helped, not trampled upon. Orphans were instantly adopted by their neighbors, and old people were cared for and revered by their children." I'm not suggesting that I would want to trade places with anybody living in the City of Joy, but I think it does illustrate powerfully the fact that happiness is not a function of all of the externals. Happiness has to do with the context in which I live my life. When I live my life from the context of scarcity, whatever exists in my life is never enough. I'm not enough. My family is not enough. The person I'm married to is not enough. My achievements are always short-lived, and my accomplishments are always short-lived. My income, whatever it is not enough. I look at my life and see what's missing instead of seeing what is. In the context of abundance, I approach my life from gratitude. I have a lot to be thankful for. Rather than seeing what's wrong with the world, I see what's right about the world. I see how I am enough. I see the blessings of my life. I see the value and goodness out of being married to the person that I'm married to and having the family that I have. I see how fortunate I am to have the income that I have and to be surrounded by the physical environment that I find myself in. I experience a wonderment about my physical body and my ability to see and to hear, about my mobility, the fact that I can get around as well as I do. I experience gratitude towards other people in my life for all of the gifts that they give me and share with me, for good friendships and good associations and support that I receive from other people. I experience gratitude about the beauty of life and the simple pleasures that I can enjoy in life on a day-to-day basis. As I view my life from an attitude of abundance, I see what is rather than what is not. I like to think of this a lot as a tuner on a radio dial. I can tune that dial to whatever station I choose. If I want, I can tune the dial on my tuner into scarcity, and I can experience everything that's wrong about life. And if I choose to look at the world from that way, and myself and my family and my circumstances, I can experience a lot of pain and unhappiness and find a lot of evidence to justify me in seeing pain and unhappiness and what's wrong. On the other hand, I can tune that dial into the abundance station, and I can see what's good about life. By looking at life through that context, I can see the blessings and the goodness and experience gratitude and all that's available to me. What is important is not so much those externals. It's not so much out there, but it has to do with the decisions that I make inside, the context that I choose to live from, whether that be scarcity or whether that be abundance. There's a poem that I'd like to read that expresses the attitude of abundance. It's written by an anonymous author. Today upon a bus, I saw a lovely maid with golden hair. I envied her, she seemed so gay, and I wished I were as fair. When suddenly she rose to leave, I saw her hobble down the aisle. She had one foot and wore a crutch, but as she passed, a smile. O God, forgive me when I whine, I have 2 feet, the world is mine. And then I stopped to buy some sweets. I talked with him. He said to me, It's nice to talk with folks like you. You see, he said, I'm blind. O God, forgive me when I whine, I have 2 eyes, the world is mine. Then walking down the street, I saw a child with eyes of blue. He stood and watched the others play. It seemed he knew not what to do. I stopped for a moment. Then I said, Why don't you join the others, dear? He looked ahead without a word, and then I knew he could not hear. O God, forgive me when I whine. I have 2 ears. The world is mine. With feet to take me where I'd go, with eyes to see the sunset's glow, with ears to hear what I would know, O God, forgive me when I whine. I'm blessed indeed, the world is mine. There's a world of wonder, a world of beauty all around us. There are miracles and blessings that are happening every day if I'm willing to tune in and view the world from that context. I believe that happiness comes not so much from what is out there, from the externals of life, but it has much more to do from the context from which I choose to view my life. As I shared with you in the introduction to these tapes, the key word is choice. All of us have incredible ability to experience our lives from choice. That has been the key word throughout the entire series of tapes. When life really works, when we can truly find happiness and peace and joy and love and meaning, is when we can challenge the old conditioning and the pre-programmed, self-defeating responses that we have to life circumstances, and begin to recognize that all of life is a matter of choice. And in fact, all choices are my choices. I understand that learning to live life from choice is a process, but it's a process, fortunately, that's available to each one of us. As we make a commitment and a decision to do so, we can experience over time the quality of our lives improving. Good luck, and I wish you the best in your search for joy and peace and happiness in your life.